It's not true that no one needs you anymore. Arthur Brooks recounts this in the opening of his book called Strength to Strength. He continues, "These exasperated words came from an elderly woman sitting behind me on a late night flight from Los Angeles to Washington, D.C. The plane was dark and quiet, and most people were either sleeping or watching a movie. A man I assumed to be her husband murmured almost inaudibly in response. Again, his wife said, 'Oh, stop saying it would be better if you were dead.' Now they had my full attention. I didn't mean to eavesdrop, but I couldn't help it. I listened half with human empathy and half with the professional fascination of a social scientist. I formed an image of the husband in my head. I imagined someone who had worked hard all his life in relative obscurity, someone disappointed at his dreams unfulfilled, perhaps the career he never pursued or the schools he never attended, the company he never started. Now I imagine he was forced to retire, tossed aside like yesterday's news. As the light switched on after touchdown, I finally got a look at the man. I was shocked. I recognized him. He was well known, famous even. Then in his mid-80s, he was been universally beloved as a hero for his courage, patriotism, and accomplishments decades ago. I had admired him since I was young." This man that Brooks writes about had achieved much, apparently had done much good, and yet sadly at the end of his life found himself feeling alone, seemingly unneeded, unwanted by others, isolated, and in despair at the very end. It's sad, but unfortunately, not hard to imagine in our world, where so often relationships are broken. Isolation is common, and loneliness seems to prevail. Is it possible to have a life of meaning with relationships that are significant in this broken world? Or are relationships even necessary? Are we better off just to go it alone? And that's what we're going to explore today. So if you have a Bible, turn with me to the book of Ecclesiastes, to Ecclesiastes 4. Ecclesiastes 4. And the Bibles will be provided near you. You can find it on page 555. Page 555. I encourage you to open up a copy of the Bible. If you have your own Bible, you're not sure where Ecclesiastes is, you can turn it to the center of your Bible. You'll likely find the book of Psalms. It goes Psalms, Proverbs, and then Ecclesiastes. If you're newer to reading the Bible, when you open it up, the larger numbers are the chapter numbers. We're in chapter 4. Smaller numbers, the verse numbers. I'll mention those throughout our time as we work our way through this chapter. And if you don't own a copy of the Bible, we as a church would love to give you one as a gift. At the back of the room, there's a table, stack of Bibles there, a sign that says free Bibles. So following the service, please just stop by that table, grab one of those, and take it with you this morning. We're in the midst of a series in the book of Ecclesiastes. That this book is a part of the Bible that we refer to as wisdom literature. And as you'll notice, we'll find out that there's a different kind of tone and feel to these wisdom books than so much of the rest of the scriptures. And in Ecclesiastes, this one referred to as the preacher, takes us along on this search for meaning in life, looking for the life that's really worth living. That's what we'll see this morning, Ecclesiastes 4. Follow along as I read aloud, beginning in verse 1. "Again, I saw all the oppressions that are done under the sun, and behold, the tears of the oppressed, and they had no one to comfort them. On the side of their oppressors, there was power, and there was no one to comfort them. And I thought the dead who were already dead more fortunate than the living who are still alive. But better than both is he who has not yet been, has not yet seen the evil deeds that are done under the sun. Then I saw that all toil and all skill and work come from a man's envy of his neighbor. This also is vanity and a striving after wind. The fool folds his hands and eats his own flesh. Better a handful of quietness than two handfuls of toil and a striving after wind. Again, I saw a vanity under the sun, one person who has no other, either son or brother, yet there's no end to all his toil. And his eyes are never satisfied with riches, so that he never asks, 'For whom am I toiling and depriving myself of pleasure?' This also is vanity and an unhappy business. Two are better than one, because they have a good reward for their toil. For if they fall, one will lift up his fellow. But woe to him who is alone when he falls and has not another to lift him up. Again, if two lie together, they keep warm. But how can one keep warm alone? And though a man might prevail against one who is alone, two will withstand him. A threefold cord is not quickly broken. Better was a poor and wise youth than an old and foolish king who no longer knew how to take advice. For he went from prison to the throne, though in his own kingdom he had been poor. I saw all the living who move about under the sun, along with the youth who was to stand in the king's place. There was no end of all the people of whom he led. Yet those who come later will not rejoice in him. Surely this also is vanity and striving after wind. This morning as we look at our passage, we'll see this emphasis. See the ruined relationships in the world and seek the better way. See the ruined relationships in the world and seek the better way. And this morning we'll look at two different categories of ruined relationships. So first we'll see against neighbor, and then second, apart from neighbor. So against our neighbor, apart from neighbor. So first we see against neighbor in verses 1-6. In our passage today, the preacher continues what he started last week, and he continues this pattern of saying, I saw. It's as if he glances here, and he makes an observation, and then he moves along to something else. I saw this. He makes an observation, and he moves on around. And friends, as he repeatedly says, I saw this and I saw that, it should cause us to consider, do we see? Are we perceiving what's happening within us and what's happening around us? First, he says that he saw all the oppressions that are done under the sun. So the first form of being against neighbor is oppression. And he says he sees oppressions all around, many forms of oppression. These are cruel and unjust uses of power. And as he observed the oppressions, he not only saw the oppressions, but notice he says he saw the tears of the oppressed, and they had no one to comfort them. No one to comfort them is repeated twice in just a couple of verses here. To emphasize what he's seeing, not just oppression, that would be bad enough, but isolation that came in it. No one to come near, no one to help bear this burden, no one to comfort the suffering. And it is a devastating image, and to portray just how bad it is, he says, the dead even have it better. Those who have never been born have it better still. These are tools that he uses, as often in wisdom literature, to shock the hearer. He intends for those words to jar us, to shake us, to wake us up, that we would see the oppression around us and its devastating effects. It would be nice if we could say, well, oppression happened back then, but it doesn't happen today. But of course, that's just not true. The world today, so long after the writing of this, still is filled with oppression. Millions of people in the world today, enslaved. A massive percentage of those in some form of sexual slavery. Ethnic cleansing still happens in our world. Racism, where one group dominates another. So many children in our nation and around the globe are facing emotional, physical, and sexual abuse. The elderly who are abandoned and abused. Million upon millions of abortions each year. So many victims of domestic violence. Around the world, unjust convictions in every court of law. In much of the world, Christians are oppressed for following Jesus. And we could spend hours naming one oppression after another around the world today. And the question we have to consider is, do we see what's going on? He saw. Do we see? And if we see, do we care? Are we moved at all by what we see? We so often distract ourselves from really seeing. Now, I'm not sure that we're able to see and process all that's going on in the world that we're now able to access instantly. By the technological tools that we have, we really can know what's happening all over the globe, and it is overwhelming, and I'm not sure we're made to be able to handle all of that. But friends, we are certainly not called to avoid. We're not called to look away from oppression, from suffering, from injustice. And part of seeing is seeking to be informed. And when we're able, in some small way, sometimes larger way, we move from being informed to being engaged. As Christians, we understand this is a fallen world where sin remains. And so there will always be limitations of what we can do in this world. But that doesn't stop us from working for some change that can be made. And friend, our King Jesus came into a world filled with oppression. And as he began his ministry, in the book of Luke, Jesus read from the prophet Isaiah. And after reading it, he says, that's about him. He says, that's about me in Luke. And here's what he says, Luke 4, beginning of verse 18, as he reads from Isaiah. The Spirit of the Lord is upon me because he has anointed me to proclaim good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim liberty to the captives, recovering of sight to the blind, to set at liberty those who are oppressed, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor. Friends, Jesus sees and cares about the oppressed. And he empowers those who've trusted in him to do the same. He calls us, empowers us to see and to care. So what can we do? In a city, in a world marked by neighbor against neighbor in this way. Well, first and fundamentally, friends, we can pray for the oppressed. You might choose maybe a particular area to seek to be more informed about so you could pray more specifically and intelligently. That'd be a good thing to do. Say, I want to learn about this area that I might pray regularly, systematically, for those who are oppressed. Second of all, we would seek to bring comfort when we're able. There are sometimes when we maybe can't do anything ourselves to alleviate this, but we can bring comfort. So how do we comfort those who have no one to comfort them? And then, when given the opportunity, we seek to work for justice. We seek to do good with the days that we have. That there are global opportunities and there are local ones as well. There's a local opportunity, a new daycare being started by some members of this church to serve families of refugees who've come to our city. This new daycare starts this fall called Dudley. Many of you have given yourselves and are giving yourselves to help make a difference in the families, the kids that will be impacted by that. The pregnancy centers in the city who help moms who find themselves with an unwanted pregnancy. There's a local organization that helps with women who are being trafficked in sort of sex activities to care for them, to help share the good news with those who are suffering in this way. Some of you in our church are serving as foster parents. You can't impact every kid, but you can impact those kids. Some of you are adopting. All of these ways to change the world, one person, one opportunity at a time. We encourage you to think about ways you might be engaged. If maybe some of those ways I mentioned you're interested in, you want more information, just write on your Connect card, tell me more about this, or I'll be at the door, but happy to connect you with those organizations. And friends, as we see and we mourn the injustice of the world, we also remember a day of perfect justice is coming. We saw that last week at the end of our passage, chapter 3, verse 17. The preacher said, I said in my heart, God will judge the righteous and the wicked, for there is a time for every matter and for every work. For the fact is, in this life, many who oppress get away with it. They don't see justice in this life. And that can be overwhelming, cause us to despair, but the Christian is mindful, a day is coming, Jesus will come and set all things right. Justice, perfect justice, will be done. So we work while we can, We entrust the justice to God that will ultimately come. Now, friends, sometimes some of you in the room may be enduring oppression now. In some way, you are being harmed by others. Friend, that's where you find yourself today. We would love the opportunity to try to serve you, comfort you, help you. So I would love to talk with you. I'll be at the door. The Connect card, you could write that. If you'd like to, you can mark confidential and nobody else will see that except for me. For we count it a privilege to try to serve you if you find yourself in that situation currently. Friend, do we see the ruined relationships in the world? And will we seek a better way? The preacher then turns his glance elsewhere to a second form of living against neighbor. Look down at verse 4, he says this, "Then I saw that all toil and all skill and work comes from a man's envy of his neighbor. This also is vanity and a striving after wind." Already in this book, the preacher has mentioned work multiple times, the toil that's a part of it from different vantage points. And so now he comes to a common hidden motive, he says, a person's envy of his neighbor. Now, as is common in wisdom literature, he states it as all to make his point. This isn't saying that absolutely every person at every moment is driven by envy. But before we let that steer our glance elsewhere, he is saying that so very often, and much more than any of us would care to admit, we are driven by envy, by jealousy of our neighbor. And he sounds the warning, this also is vanity. It's like vapor that's here and gone. It's striving after the wind. Friends, envy and jealousy are very real and a threat to every human heart, including yours, including mine. Envy is when I find myself wanting, desiring someone else's situation, their possessions, their success. I'm desiring their life. And often embedded in that envy is a sense of resentment towards them. And I'm saying this is true for everyone, but I think for many people we find who we're most prone to envy are not those people who are very far from us, way above us or way different than us, but often it's those who are perhaps most like us. It's the person who you graduated with, who's further down the road than you. It's the coworker who you started with, and now they're two rungs above you. And they seem to just be climbing faster. It's the one you're working side by side with, and they seem to get all the accolades, and you don't. For often it's those people we know, who are so often prone to envy. And the result is that we work harder and harder, we study harder and harder, but it's just never enough. We just can't seem to catch up. They seem to keep moving ahead, and we can't find it, and so we are eaten up within. Envy may show itself when this other person is happy, when they're celebrating and you are actually unhappy at their happiness. You don't show that, of course. You show outwardly that you're happy for them. You congratulate them. But inside, you're eaten up with envy. Or when another is unhappy, or failing, or struggling, or lost their job, you're happy at their unhappiness, at their struggles. My friends, it's impossible for us to truly love our neighbor, which we're called to, while we're envying them. You can't truly love your coworker or fellow student when your heart is envying them. My friends, within the family of the church, we can't truly love one another for envying the other person. So, friend, I wonder, where might envy today, this week, be present or be lurking in your life? And when others are succeeding around you, are you sometimes, if you're honest, secretly sad, disappointed? When others in your life stumble or fail, are you secretly glad? Now we might think, well, I won't stoop to envy. So instead of having an envy-fueled ambition, I'll choose the path of having no ambition at all. No drive at all in life. So we see the other extreme. Look down at verse 5. It says, the fool folds his hands and eats his own flesh. The image of the folding of the hands is the image of laziness, of just stopping working. So this is a person who has a pattern of life of laziness. And friend, I wonder, is it possible that you're living that way? Or you're still going to work, or you're still logging on, you're still in the classroom, but you're doing as little as possible. You know, just enough emails to send, or just enough time to move your mouse if they're watching you, just to see if you're really still online. But the fact is, you're checked out. You couldn't say that you're working hard to the glory of God, because lazy has crept in. Our work and study driven by envy can never satisfy, but nor can the path of laziness. It's self-destructive, as it says here. So neither of those are the path, and thankfully the preacher offers us a better way. Look at verse 6. He says, better is a handful of quietness than two hands full of toil and striving after the wind. Friend, one of the dangers is when we're driven by envy and jealousy, that ambition can fuel us and we can actually do a lot of work. We might have some success because we're so driven by that, and we might do enough work that our hands are filled with accolades, but we're also lacking in peace. There's no contentment in our hearts. So our hands are full of accumulation, and yet we're still not satisfied. We're still envious of others, and there's no calm within. The better way is to have a hand that is full, but it's full of quietness. It's full of peace. Author David Gibson says it this way. Quietness is a word to capture the deep well-being of those who know their place in the world, content with the boundary lines of their life and able to enjoy the fruits of their labors with a cheerful heart. Friend, this is a picture of contentment. And this better way is available to us through Jesus Christ. The Apostle Paul writes of this to Timothy in 1 Timothy chapter 6, verse 6 and 7. Godliness with contentment is great gain. For we brought nothing into the world, and we cannot take anything out of the world. Friend, we want to see the ruined neighbor relationships in the world and seek the better way. At times we live against our neighbor, but that's not the only threat, which brings us to second, living apart from our neighbor. So sometimes we're against our neighbor, but sometimes we're living apart from our neighbor. We see this in verses 7 through 16. The preacher's glance now turns to another form of vanity. Look at verse 8. He says, one person who has no other either son or brother, yet there's no end to all his toil. And his eyes are never satisfied with riches, so that he never asks, for whom am I toiling and depriving myself of pleasure? This also is vanity and an unhappy business. So here's a person who works and works and works, but he has no one who he's sharing with what he accumulates. He gives of his labors, but there's no one he's providing for. So he's never satisfied himself, even though he's setting aside pleasure for this pursuit of work, but he works so hard, he doesn't have time to pause and ask himself the question in the text, which is, for whom am I doing this? Who am I working so hard for? Friends, this can show up in our lives as well. We're working and working and working, but working for a self-isolated existence. This can happen broadly in relationships and friendships where you're working and studying so much that you're just never available. And you always think, well, next week, next month, I'll invest in relationships. I'll start working less, investing more. But next week and next month just never seem to come. So you're busy at work, but your life is empty of relationships. And to be clear, it's not because you have to work all those times. You're not trying to survive. It's just become your life. It could also show up in a person who does have some desire for marriage but thinks, I don't have time right now. I need to work more. I need to advance more in my studies. So there's a day for marriage, but I don't have time for that now. But one season leads to another season, leads to another season. There's an equal danger within those who are married. We work and we work and we work and we're so busy, but the relationship withers because of an unwillingness to spend time. It's the parent who's working so hard on one level to provide for their kids, but it's gone beyond simply providing for, so that now all the work is done, but there's actually no time spent with our kids. And they would always choose more time with you than with the things you could buy for them. But friends, thankfully, there's a better way. There's a way for us to diligently work, not laziness, but work for others, to provide for ourselves, to provide for those who are a part of our lives, and to open a way to generosity, but also clearing time for relationships in our days. Friends, we want to see the ruined neighbor relationships in the world and seek this better way. The preacher then turns to draw our attention to just how desperately every person needs relationships. So he says, look down at verse 9, two are better than one because they have a good reward from their toil. So he's saying two people who are in a relationship are in a better spot than these two individuals just going their own way, living in self-isolation. Why is this so? First, verse 10, he says, if they fall, one will lift up his fellow. But woe to him who falls alone and yet has not another to lift him up. In the world of that day and the geography where the preacher was, it was a difficult and dangerous place to walk. So many ways you could stumble and fall. And so if you fall, there's no one to help you up. You're in grave danger. So better to have a traveling partner. It just makes sense. Two are better than one. But he continues on, verse 11. Again, if two lie together, they keep warm. But how can one keep warm alone? This also is just a common sense outlook. There's nothing sexual at all to this. But in the world of that day, if you're traveling and it's cold, and you have the opportunity to either lay by yourself or lay near your traveling companion, you're going to stay warmer if you lay near the person who you're with. And more in verse 12, though a man might prevail against one who is alone, two will withstand him. If you're attacked, if you're alone, the likelihood of surviving is much lower, but if there are two of you together, it's a much greater opportunity that you might make it out. Two is better than one. It's basic math, isn't it? It's safer. It's more fruitful. But what's better than two? Three. So he says, verse 12, a threefold cord is not quickly broken. Now, this verse is sometimes applied to marriage as if that's the primary application. This certainly can be applied to marriage, but that's not the central point. It's much broader than that. It's reminding us we're made for human relationships. We desperately need them. And we'll live a safer, more substantial, more fruitful life in these relationships. From the reality is each of us in this room need real, ongoing friendships. And we need friendships that are in proximity to us. On one hand, we're blessed to live in the world that has the incredible technological tools that we have today, so that you can talk with friends all around the world in an instant. We did that with our grandsons last night, and it's so awesome. They don't live near us. That on the video, we can see and laugh together and talk. But that's not the same as being in the same room. You can maintain friendships around the world, and you should. But we should be careful of thinking that if we have sufficient friendships around the country or around the world, that we can get by without friends where we are. Friend, you need friendships, even if they're new ones, where you live. Your friend who's across the continent cares deeply for you, but they can't sit in the same room with you today. They can't see you face to face. They can't, no matter how much they want to, give you an actual hug. That's why we need friends, new and old ones, friends who are far and friends who are near. So I wonder, are you trying to get by with only friendships that are miles away? Or are you trying to get by without friendships? Maybe you've had good ones, some disappointing ones, you've been hurt by them. You've decided, I just don't need friends. I'm just going to go it alone. Friend, you see that each of us need these committed relationships. It's unwise, it's unsafe, it's at our peril that we try to go it alone. We see the ruined neighbor relationships in the world. We want to choose to seek the better way. The preacher then takes one last glance, verses 13 to 16. He tells of an aging king who has now no longer willing to listen to the advice of others. Now that implies there was a time when he did listen. He had some relationships around him, willing to give him some advice. And at one point he would listen, but now he's unwilling to receive counsel. He's distanced himself from those in his life. So now it was better for the country to have this poor, young, wise youth to rise up and to take his place. We see in the end that those who come later will not rejoice in the king. For this was a failed king, but thankfully, there's an infinitely greater, wiser, more loving king, and that is Jesus Christ, God the Son. And this king has come near. He came into this world taking on flesh. And as Jesus walked the earth, he called us, called all who follow him, to love God and to love neighbor. But he not only called us to that, he showed us that. He showed us how to love neighbor. As he walked in love for insiders and outsiders, as he walked in compassion and mercy, love, grace to his neighbors, he always told his neighbors the truth. No one has ever loved neighbor like Jesus. But during his ministry, he actually calls us beyond only loving neighbors. He tells us in Matthew chapter 5, verse 43 and 44. He says, "You've heard that it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say to you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you." So Jesus says, yes, love for neighbor, but it's beyond that. It actually now becomes, love your enemies. Pray for them. And Jesus did that in perfection. As he went to a Roman cross, and as he was hung on the cross, unjustly hung on the cross, he did nothing wrong. And the sinless Son of God was hanging on the cross, there bearing our shame and our guilt. While he hung there, he prayed for those who oppressed him, those who were putting him to death. His prayer for them, "Father, forgive them, for they don't know what they're doing." He prayed for his enemies. He loved his enemies. And even loved us, who were his enemies. Because we lived in opposition to him, rebelling against his kingdom. And yet Christ died to save sinners like us, enemies like us, and to move us from enemies to children of God. All of this provided through Christ's death in our place, his burial, his resurrection, all of grace to open up this free gift of salvation held out to any and all who would receive it by faith. And in the salvation, we're reconciled to God, no longer an enemy, now a friend, no longer an enemy, now a child of God, adopted into God's own family. We're forgiven of all of our envy. He paid for all of our envy, all of our jealousy, any oppression even that we've done, Christ paid for that. And he brings us into a new life now and into life eternal. And friend, if you're not a Christian this morning, we're so glad you give part of your morning. And we so much want you to know this Jesus, this perfect King, this one who loved like no others. Those of us in the room who are Christians, we're called to love neighbor. That's our aspiration, but we don't do that perfectly. And if you stay here for a while, you'll see that we won't love perfectly, but Jesus loved perfectly. No one has ever loved like Jesus. Look to him. Trust in him. Friend, this might be very new to you. If so, we just want you to know you're welcome next week as we, again, will think about Jesus, worship Jesus, consider his grace. Or maybe you'd like to know more. You can note that on the Connect card. We'd arrange a time if you'd like to talk with someone. Or if you'd like to know more today, I'll be at the door on your way out. I would love nothing more than to tell you about Jesus and his grace. And friends, for those who are Christians, we're now united with Christ and empowered by the Spirit to join in this calling to love neighbor. That's what we give ourselves to, so now we can engage with injustice and oppression in the world. For there's work that can be done. Yes, there are limitations, but by God's grace, we can do what's before us individually and as a congregation. Friend, through Christ, our envy and jealousy that once drove our work is forgiven. And friend, now by the Holy Spirit, it's possible to live differently. Friend, can you imagine the freedom, the relief you would have if that person from work who you've previously envied gets a promotion and you could legitimately be happy for them? And how God would be glorified in that. Friends, that's possible by the Spirit's work in us. We actually can celebrate their success. Christ also came to empower in us contentment. Godliness with contentment is his desire for us. And friends, it's possible by the Spirit. So that you could work hard, you could accumulate what God might provide, but then you can join in generosity because you're content and you found peace, quietness from God. You can now work hard and support and love others who are in need around you. Christ calls us to love neighbor, but he also brings us beyond neighbor love to the love of the local church, the love in the family of God. This too is beyond simply our love of neighbor. Jesus says it this way, John 13, 34 and 35. A new command I give to you, that you love one another just as I've loved you, you also are to love one another. By this, all people will know that you are my disciples if you have love for one another. So within the family of Jesus Christ, which we're brought into through salvation, we're now family in God. And we're to love one another in the way that Christ loved us. And he says that will be distinctive. That will mark us out that we truly know him when we love like that. And friend, in a world where neighbor against neighbor is so common and natural, where isolation and loneliness dominate as it dominates our city, the devoted covenant family of God is truly odd and unique and attractive. And friend, if two are better than one, and three is better than two, then five is better than three. And 10 is better than five. And 50 is better than 10. Friend, that in the family of the church, that God brings us into this covenant community, imperfect as it is, but those saved by grace, united together. Friend, the Christian is not intended to go it alone. So many think they can, so many try it. But friend, if you fall down spiritually and you're going it alone, who will help you up? Friend, when your soul grows cool to God, but there's no one there to help you warm your soul, where will you turn? So we join the covenant of the family of God in the local church, and there we commit. When one falls, we help each other up. This person falls this time, but in the future, it'll be me falling, and someone will help me up. And when our hearts grow cool, we have others near us to help us warm our hearts in Christ. So friend, therefore, let me urge you, if you're a Christian, join a local church. Find a church that holds out this good news of Jesus Christ and put down roots in that. It's the time of year in Boston when people are moving in and they're also moving away. Friend, if you're new to Boston, if you're just new this week, welcome to Boston. We're so glad you're here. It won't get much cooler than this year-round here in Boston, so we're glad you're here. But let me encourage you, friend, if you're a Christian, find a local church and join that church. You may have a church that you love where you moved from. I'd say give thanks to God for that. But you can't stay there because you don't live there anymore. They wouldn't want you to continue in membership there. So you need to find a church here. And friend, we would love to help you in that. We know Hope is not the church for everyone. So friend, if you would like help finding a church, you could let me know. I'd love to help you find a church. But some of you are still going to move away from Boston this summer. And as you move from Hope, it's our prayer that you give thanks to God for your time here. But you can't stay a member here. When you move 1,000 miles away, we love you, but we're no longer in the same proximity. So you need to find a church there to join. And as you move, please let us know. We often spend time finding members, churches we can recommend as you move. Please just email me. We'd love to help find something we could recommend you to. All of us need a local church. Friend, during the summer, people come and go with vacation and various things, and that's great. I hope you embrace that as you have the opportunity. But when we are in town, the blessing of summer in Boston is the days are longer. The days at least feel a little bit slower. So why not give your time this summer, among other things, to drawing closer to your family in the church? A number of things you might consider doing. One, I would encourage you, come earlier on Sunday morning. Like before the service is theoretically possible. And just think about it, if you come early, you can get as close to the air conditioner as you want. So if you want to be close to the air conditioner, those are the choice seats, so come early for that. So come early. Second of all, I would encourage you, linger longer after the service. What's the rush? We rush all week long. Stay around a little bit longer for a conversation, to meet someone new, to say hello to someone you haven't seen in a long time. Join us on Wednesday evenings. We're having a Bible study on Wednesdays from 7 to 8. Join us here for that. Join us tonight as we have pizza just down the street. Take advantage of those opportunities. To do that would be good for you, but friend, also there is good that you can do for others by your presence, by your listening ear. You could be an encouragement, probably in a way you don't even realize. Let's give ourselves to that. The man on the plane at the beginning, his wife tried to assure him as she said, "It's not true that no one needs you anymore." Friend, the fact is, others need you. People in this room need you. And friend, you need them. You need others. We all need others. We each have opportunities to love our neighbor, to love one another. May we give ourselves to that. Let's give ourselves to seeing the ruined neighbor relationships in the world and then choosing to seek the better way that Jesus has for us.